4-day weekend? Who gets a 4-day weekend? But I do get a 3-day weekend, and that's why we're presenting some of our favorite best of segments here on the Dory Monson Show. But I will be on the air Sunday morning, 7 a.m. Our pregame show begins. I won't even have things digested by then. But 7 a.m., our pregame coverage begins on Sunday between the Seahawks and the Carolina Panthers. I'll be joined by Paul Moyer, Ray Roberts, Jordan Babineau, Michael Bumpus. Crucial game for the Seahawks as they try to stay in the playoff picture. So we will be on the air at 7 a.m. The kickoff is at 10 right here on your home of the Seattle Seahawks, 97.3 Cairo FM. So I will see you live Sunday morning for Seahawks football. I'll see you live Monday afternoon at high noon for a new edition of the Dory Monson Show. And in the meantime, enjoy some of our favorite best of segments on this holiday Friday on the Dory Monson Show. Oh, man, if you want to talk about a band that was a huge part of the soundtrack of my high school and college years, you're listening to it right now. Styx. They're going to be here next month at the beautiful Tulalip Amphitheater. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. And one of the founding members of Styx, James Young, joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. James, what a pleasure to talk to you, sir. This is quite a career you've put together. You started with the band in 1970, right?
Yes, the band was called something else at the time, and I just come from my band breaking up after we played the first rock festival in Illinois, playing all original music back in 1970, the year after Woodstock. Irving Azoff put that thing on, but then my band sort of fell apart for whatever reason, and these guys were working, and they... And playing original music was difficult to get paid, and so I decided it was time as a professional musician you actually have to get paid for what you do. So we started working together with them in November of 70, and the combination of their sense of what the average guy wanted and me sense of what was going on at the cutting edge, we had a recording contract signed on February 22nd, 1972.
And it was kind of a unique sound you were blending, because I know that you personally were kind of the harder rocker, and then you eventually had the very mellow songs that you blended in the albums. It was kind of a unique blend of that synth rock and hard stuff and ballads, and it was a unique sound that you guys carved out.
Well, we were influenced by a lot of different things. I was fortunate enough to see Jimi Hendrix play live 5 times before he passed, and but we were also influenced by classical things like Yes and certainly the Beatles. And I also liked stuff like Deep Purple and Jeff Beck and whatever thing he did. So I'm into Cream, Eric Clapton kind of a thing. But the rest of the guys were a little more on the pop side, but we were managed to sort of put the orchestral thing in the middle, and the piece you just played for, in the intro from Fooling Yourself, actually, I wrote that line, and then Dennis kind of orchestrated it beyond that. But we definitely found common ground, and but didn't feel like we had to stay in a narrow sense of this is what we do. We felt we could do what the Beatles did and kind of go all over the place stylistically.
You know, it's really interesting to me because you're talking on a Seattle radio station. Jimi Hendrix was from Seattle. I had a member of the Isley Brothers on my show last week, and he talked about how they kind of found Jimi Hendrix back in 63. Yeah. And it's amazing to me for a guy who died at age 27, how lasting and widespread his influence was with groups as diverse as the Isley Brothers and Styx and dozens of others too.
He was something brand new. He was the fusion of Buddy Guy and R&B with British psychedelicism, and it just kind of, and the, you know, it was like somebody came down from the second moon of Mars and dressed like he was from some place from outer space,
right,
and just blew everybody's mind. I mean, Monterey Pop Festival, that tape there, him doing Wild Thing, you know, his version of it is just like, this guy oozes sexuality, and yet he's so cerebral in so many other ways. It just was a crazy, wonderful, powerful thing to witness live and to hear on record.
You are known yourself as such a great guitarist. Was Hendrix the best, or who else belongs in that pantheon of the best ever?
Well, for me, you've got Beck. You've got Hendrix. You've got Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck. Those are there, and then, I mean, there's a host of other guys that came later. Eddie Van Halen, obviously, sort of broke the next cutting edge beyond that. And, you know, they're just Alvin Lee 10 years after in the Woodstock movie, the I'm Going Home kind of a thing. But it, you know, Hendrix definitely was the most profound influence on me, but the rest of the guys kind of filled in the blanks for my playing style. And, you know, the best is beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and there's nobody could do what he did.
Yeah.
You know?
So, yep. But just amazing to think when he died so young that he still had that much influence. A few minutes ago, when you were talking about your style and the blend of styles, you mentioned Dennis, which is Dennis DeYoung,
yeah,
of course. Whatever happened there with you guys? Because he was such a vocal part of your distinctive sound, and I'm always amazed at the bands. You know, and I know you guys perform with Don Felder of the Eagles, and I've watched that great documentary about, you know, how the ups and downs. What's the dynamic when you have such a distinct part of your band and you just can't keep it together?
Well, the whole thing was a collaborative effort, and
it always is.
But Dennis was sort of, he needed to be, you know, the alpha dog, and the rest of the, I mean, I was, you know, I was happy to be part of something that was great, and Tommy Shaw came in and replaced John Cerulski, and Tommy himself is another, you know, possible alpha dog. But we all kind of saw things a little bit differently, and we just, starting at the end of the Paradise Theater tour, we just had 3 million sellers in a row. We just sold out 110 arenas in North America, and Dennis wanted to make a hard left turn on the wheel. None of us really wanted to do it, but he said he couldn't go any further. He couldn't work with our manager anymore. Then he insisted on doing this project that was very ambitious in terms of creating a film and based on a storyline, and we were all really against it, but he just kept he kept after us, and ultimately, on a day of weakness, we all gave into it. But it just got out of control with new management, with Dennis just sort of no checks and balances. It was his baby to either this was going to succeed mightily, which I've been wrong about some of his stuff before, so I was willing to give him a chance.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, Mr. Roboto was such a hard left turn on the wheel for all our diehard, you know, male rock fans anyway.
Right.
That you know, we wound up selling half as many records as we did the years before, and half as many concert tickets, and we hated each other at the end of it all because none of us wanted to do it, and it was not the success he predicted it would be. It was quite the opposite. So we went apart.
Yeah. I'm amazed that doesn't happen more often because, like you said, people who gravitate to that business tend to be more the alpha dogs, and you know, when I see bands like the Stones and the Who that are still out filling arenas and selling out places, and, you know, essentially, I know they've had some bumps along the road, but when they keep it together, and you guys have most of your founding members still, I think that's pretty impressive when bands can keep it together to the extent that you guys all have.
Well, you know, what happened, people will say, you know, was there going to be a reunion with him? And we had a reunion after 13 years of not working together from 83 to 96. We got back together and couldn't sell records anymore because MTV, which was the tail of wag, the industry dog, basically was not interested in new music from us or anybody like us, really. And because the Seattle Sound took over, Kurt Cobain,
yep.
You know, thank you very much, Soundgarden, love Soundgarden. And, But things change. Things change as things do in life. And we had a very successful reunion tour in '96. But then Dennis all immediately was not interested in really continuing the band full bore. He had some other project he was still working on, and so he only gave us a certain amount of time. The next year, gave us no time. The following year, and then the next year, wanted to make a record, but didn't want to go on the road. And we knew we weren't going to be selling records because just nobody was who was from our genre at that point in our generation.
Yeah.
And they're refusing to go on the road. We just said, we're going with you, without you. And we offered him the opportunity to be part of whatever shows he could make, felt he could make. And he didn't want us to do that. And we said, we're going to do that. And he thought we would fail. And we succeeded without him, as I knew we would.
Right.
And he sued us in federal court over the use of the name. And I can't say we won, but we settled out of court. And we have the use of the name. And he's got very limited use of the name and is very narrowly defined how he can use the name. Dennis DeYoung performing the music of Styx. So,
right.
I God bless Dennis DeYoung. He's a really talented guy. You know, I wish him success and happiness and joy. He just didn't want to be part of this band.
Yeah, that happens. We're talking with.
He didn't basically want to succumb to majority rule. He wanted to lead.
Okay, got it. We're talking with James Young, one of the founding members of Styx. They're going to be up at Tulalip next month. And I was watching a bunch of videos, James, last night in preparation for talking to you. And one of the songs that you personally are most closely associated with is this one, Snowblind. And as I'm watching one of the live videos, I see you are giving a disclaimer at the beginning of the song because someone accused you guys of putting what was that all about? Satanic backtracking messages in it or something?
No, this was backward satanic messages.
Okay.
Now, if you play any spoken word backwards, it sounds like Satan is speaking it because it's not. It sounds like foreign gibberish, and if you slow it down,
sure.
You know, it sounds like Linda Blair has resurrected herself and is talking into your microphone.
Right.
God bless Linda. She's a friend, and two of our current members dated her way back when. So,
nice.
But the and she's doing well. I'm happy to report.
Good.
But that was, I don't know, the certain, you know, rock music was always, even going back to the time of Elvis, it was, you know, this is the music of the devil.
Right.
And every so often, somebody, you know, rears up and says, you know, this is evil, and they start listening to records backwards.
Right. Right.
Nobody listens to records backwards. And even if they did, so... supposedly I said, I try so hard to make it so. You turn that around, they say, and it's, oh, Satan, move through your voices. But it doesn't really sound like that when you play it back. This is a huge stretch. So it was just, you know, it was just, so the next record, we intentionally put some backwards
of course, yeah.
stuff on the front.
Of course.
You know.
I just thought it was funny that you still, you know, at times disclaim that when you do this song live, because I'd never even heard about that before.
Well, that video must be pretty old. The video must go back to
when
the video was probably 1996, because that's, I think, when did our reunion tour of '96. We videotaped that one. Yeah,
yeah. This is you right here.
Might have happened on the Kilroy videotape as well.
Okay, this is you right here on guitar, right?
That's me.
That's you right there. Yeah, this is a great song. What a great song. All right, well, Styx is going to be up at the Tulalip Amphitheater. Have you played up here in Seattle much? I know you've been down a few times.
We played Tulalip about 2 years ago.
Okay.
And had a wonderful time there. And looking forward to coming back.
Yeah, I hope it's a warm summer night because it's a great venue, and you'll have a blast up there. I know you will. And you guys still sound...
The last time, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, you guys still sound great. I was watching recent videos, too, and...
Oh, mama, there
we go.
For my life.
There he is.
I picked all songs from your current tour playlist, too. Just
beautiful.
Yeah, so... It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's a lot of fun for me to talk to you, James. Like I said, you guys are part of the soundtrack of my life, so I appreciate it.
The soundtrack of your glorious misspent youth, as our guy Terry Gibson would say.
Exactly right. All right. Well, I'd love to catch up with you when you're in town next month, too.
All right, man. We'll see if we can hook that up.
Okay. All right. James, good talk to you. Safe travels to you.
Sounds good, man. Okay.
Okay. James All Young.
Right.
One of the founding members of Styx. Like I said, you can get tickets, Ticketmaster.com, or no fees if you go to the Tulalip box office. And we have lots more straight ahead as the Dory Monson Show rolls on. Recovering from a day of indulgence yesterday, Thanksgiving. So we're presenting some of our favorite segments here on the Dory Monson Show. Getting ready for the Apple Cup a little bit later today. We got our Husky and Coug flags flying. Our freak flag is flying at the Monson House, the house divided. So got the Apple Cup coming up later today. Hope you enjoyed that as well. In the meantime, here are some of our favorite segments on the Dory Monson Show. Well, the history of the Seattle Seahawks, they have really had two great owners. Paul Allen, who passed away yesterday at the age of 65. And then there was the original Seahawks owner, John Nordstrom, who helped bring this team to Seattle the first time around. Paul Allen saved the team for Seattle. And the legendary John Nordstrom joins us here on Cairo Radio. Mr. Nordstrom, my friend, how are you, sir?
Well, you're very nice to say that, but you were correct in one account. Paul was fantastic. We were so hot, we ended up selling it to Behring, who really messed it up. So don't give us high marks.
No, you know what, though? I was no fan of Ken Behring, but I also know all the guy or many of the guys who played when you owned the team, and they loved you. So you get very high marks from my friends who got to know you very well.
Well, you're nice to say that, and I'm glad that Paul ended up with it because he was, in my mind, the best owner in the league.
Yes, I would agree with you. I mean, look, the team had only won three playoff games in their history before Paul Allen acquired the team. And then there was a culture of winning that was instilled that led to three Super Bowl appearances, one win, a run like the team had never seen before. What do you think made him such a great owner?
Well, what he doesn't get enough credit for is he bought it right at the rock bottom. That was our very, very lowest point. And he came in and paid Behring double what Behring had paid for it and was worried that he was paying too much. I tried to tell him that I thought the future was bright, but I understood he was a little worried about paying that much for the team. And then he had a lot more work to do when he said, we're not going to play in the kingdom. We want an outdoor stadium, and that is a multi-purpose closed stadium, and
sure,
I don't like it for football. So he went to the authorities and said, if you're not willing to tear the kingdom down and replace it with an outdoor stadium, then I'm probably not going to be your buyer.
Well, it's worked out pretty well for the city, and CenturyLink is a great place. So you were somewhat instrumental in the approaching of Paul Allen, weren't you?
Yeah, I was really worried that because we had sold it to Behring and messed it up, that it was is going to end up badly for the city. And so I got after it and made sure that Paul, at least he was, and by gosh, he was willing. He was more than willing to save the team for the city. I got to give him 100% of the credit. Don't give me any. Give it all to Paul. He was something else.
Because he wasn't really a football guy. I mean, he was an NBA guy. That was his passion, and he really did see this more as a civic gift than an ego play.
Yep.
It seemed.
I told him, I said, I think at some point you're gonna like football just as much as basketball. He said, I don't think so.
You got to interact with him personally. Give me some personal insights as to the man that made him a giant, not just in business, not just in sports, but in philanthropy and exploring the brain and exploring space and exploring the deep seas. I mean, this is a guy who seemed to jump in with both feet with everything he did in life.
That's the understatement of the year. He was absolutely amazing. And the amount of attention he gave to the team with all that other stuff going on, he knew about the team. I told him that after he'd owned it a while, I said, Paul, you ought to go down and greet these guys when they come back off the field on their way to the locker room and shake their hand, because they would love to press the flesh with you.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, I'll do it. So he did. He'd stand at the entrance of the locker room, even after a loss, and as each guy came in, he would give them a hand clasp. And I tell you, that meant something. At least I think it did.
What do you think make that drive? Because you run with some pretty impressive business leaders. What is it that put Paul Allen a notch above so many others?
In the way he made decisions. He made them quickly, and he made them positively, and he was amazingly right when he made a decision to change from this person to this person, or to build this building or whatever he did. He was uncannily correct. I was really amazed, because I've been around a lot of people who will make about 50% good decisions and 50% shaky ones.
Right.
He didn't. He was relentless. I was so impressed.
Would you call yourselves friends?
I don't know. Well, I was more than happy to be in his company. I had a hard time getting a word out of him, but he would talk to me, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, we're talking with John Nordstrom, who told me on my show, what, a year or two ago, that selling to the Barings was the worst decision you ever made. And so I know that it had to be a tremendous relief to you, as much as you cared about this team, to see it handed over to somebody like Paul Allen.
We didn't think it would turn out this well, frankly. Because he was a basketball guy, we didn't realize that he would do with it what he has done with it. And the Seahawks have been incredibly successful under his ownership. We are all pretty lucky.
As a man who has owned the Seahawks yourself, what do you think happens next ownership-wise with this franchise?
As I said, I think he was the best owner in the league. If we get anybody in here to own the team that's anywhere near close to Paul Allen, we are going to be very, very lucky. I am holding my breath. We all should hold our breath. Because it's extremely important who that next individual is that owns the team.
John Nordstrom with us. By the way, I had a lovely lunch with your son in London. You didn't respond to my the pictures I texted you. What's up with that?
Well, you know, you guys, you were holding a glass of beer, as I recall.
Well, he was.
Oh, he was. Okay. You guys weren't behaving yourselves. I don't think...
You've, I bet you, four lovely grandkids there too. You've got a beautiful family. I know you have others too, but I met that part of your family. Beautiful.
Well, you're so nice to say that, and they are also number one Seahawks fans, as you can tell.
Oh, I do know. All right, well, John, it's always great talking with you, and I know I end every conversation this way. When are we going flying?
We're going flying at Kenmore whenever you say so. I got the airplane ready.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to take you up on it. I'm not going to keep talking about it.
I love it. I love it.
Okay. John, you're a really good friend. I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for coming on with me today.
Dory, you're the best. Thanks.
The original Seahawk owner, John Nordstrom, joining us. Love to hear your thoughts. The Online Trading Academy text line is 98973. We have lots more straight ahead on the Dory Monson Show. We are presenting some of our favorite segments, interviews, other stuff that we've done in the recent past here on the Dory Monson Show. We will be back Monday, high noon, with an all-new program. But in the meantime, enjoy some of our favorite segments here on the Dory Monson Show. Well, if you're listening to my show on Monday, I talked to a young woman. She was training for the New York Marathon, Maria Ball. And on Friday morning, 6:30, she was going for a 16-mile training run. She was in the Green Lake Ravenna neighborhood when a homeless man jumped out, grabbed her breast, grabbed her crotch, and her screams helped fight off this person. He's still at large, and the police suspect that this was the second sexually motivated assault that this guy has committed in just the last week or so. So Maria came on my show because she said, I wish I'd known about the assault a week ago in that neighborhood because I would have altered my route. And she wanted to get the word out. And of course, somebody else who has spoken out a lot on this issue is Kelly Herron, who was brutally assaulted in an attempted rape at Golden Gardens while training for a marathon. And Kelly Herron joins us here on Cairo Radio. Kelly, it's always good to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you, Dory. It's a pleasure.
You must have some very strong emotions when, you know, a year after your attack, you hear stories about what's continuing to happen to these young women who are out doing the healthiest of activities in our region.
Absolutely. It absolutely crushes me. And I totally respect Maria for wanting to get the word out. And, you know, that was my mission too. And it's like, okay, so people are hearing it. People are taking some self-defense classes, but that's not the solution. At best, it's a Band-Aid. And if people are hearing it and taking action, they're not the ones who are running the city, and that's who should be listening.
Yeah.
They didn't listen when it happened to me. They didn't listen when it happened to my friend at Carter Subaru. They didn't listen when my first responder, Brett Cameron, was assaulted with his daughter at Green Lake. Like, and are they going to listen now? And even on Twitter yesterday, someone said, why are people running there? Well, if we can't run at Green Lake and we can't run at Golden Gardens and we can't run at Carkeek Park,
right,
and we are pretty close to not being able to run on Burt Gilman, I'm sure it's any day now, where are we supposed to run?
Yeah, no, it's, look, you say, when are our politicians going to start listening? They never will. This current group never will, because we have a current group of politicians that are deaf, dumb, and blind. And until we just start cleaning house from the incompetence that we have running the city right now, things are not going to change.
It's so disappointing. Actually, Dory, I just moved out of Seattle because I was just so frustrated seeing it every day, running by it every day. I just couldn't, it was becoming a mental health issue for me. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to leave Seattle or the last for this very reason.
Well, the reason I wanted to reach out to you today, Kelly, was because as I was talking to Maria on Monday, she said something to me that I wanted to make sure you heard. And here's what she said.
When this was happening, all I could think was, oh my God, does he have a weapon? Does he have a knife? Does he have a gun? Is this it? Am I going to die? And I seriously, all I could think about was Kelly and her story and how she fought back. And I screamed even louder because I was not going to let that guy take me down.
And Kelly, when I heard that, because when you first came on my show, right after you were attacked and you were so banged up still, that was the reason you spoke out. And I hope you feel proud of the fact that your words back then continue to have a positive impact, and people hearing your story and hearing "not today, mother bleeper," and just the ferocity with which you fought, it locked into the minds of a lot of women. And I thought that was proof of the positive impact you speaking out has had.
Yeah, and it means a lot, and it does make me feel like what I went through was worth it. I've heard dozens of stories from women around the country and even the world who have written to me and said, you know, either they were in a situation that they thought, where they where they maybe normally wouldn't have done something, but they trusted their instincts and maybe crossed to the other side of the street, or when they were a little bit more aggressive with someone who they felt threatened by. And, that makes me, it's overwhelming and very humbling. And I'm glad that that message is getting out. And I do believe that it is helping and saving people. And, unfortunately, self-defense is not a guarantee of safety.
Sure.
But it does give you the best chance of survival. If you're ever in that situation, you need to be able to call upon something other than just adrenaline and survival instinct.
Yeah.
Having those tools in your back pocket are what is going to save you. It's honestly what saved me.
Well, and the only thing I'd challenge you on a bit, and I know you probably didn't mean this literally, you said that it makes what happened to you worth it. And I would say there's no counterbalance. There's no fair counterbalance for anybody who's assaulted. But what it did is it took this nightmare situation you went through and you made something as positive as possible out of that. And that's, where I'm proud of you for that.
Thank you, Dory. The way that my life has changed and the good that has come to me, I do feel like, I mean, it should never happen to anyone, but it became sort of a calling in my life and gave me a higher purpose than I have ever had.
Yep.
And I'm proud of the impact it's had. I'm happy that Maria heard me, and I'm happy that she was able to dig deep and, let out that primal scream. I just did it on the Hood to Coast relay, running through downtown Portland at midnight. Mm. it's in all of us.
Sure.
And so I would just encourage people to educate themselves, practice, role play, take a course. Even if you never need it, you're going to feel more confident, walk a little with your head a little higher, be more aware of your situation. And if you ever need it, it's going to give you the best chance to survive.
Absolutely. Well, it's a shame that so many people, especially our women and girls, that they encounter this so frequently here in Seattle. But the message is, you scream at the top of your lungs, you fight with every fiber of your being, you gouge their eyes, you knee them in the groin, you give it everything you have and never give in to these maniacs that are running around on the streets.
Absolutely. And also, try to take a mental note of anything that you can about their description at all. Because if they get away, that you're going to be the only one who can provide that information. So when I see a suspicious person, I try to think of, like, what movie character do they look like? Like, the guy who attacked me, does he not look like Merv from Home Alone?
Wow.
So just kind of making those little mental notes to yourself are really going to help law enforcement if needed.
I like it. Well, Kelly, always great touching base with you, and we'll stay in touch. I appreciate you coming on with me today.
Thanks so much, Dory.